So, yet again I find myself in a curious predicament. Here I am in Boston, in the United States of America, in a very cold and snowy day. And it's time for another episode of In a Perfect World, listeners. And you won't believe where we are. We're just with a very lovely gentleman I've met here in Boston, the name of Benton Rooks. And we've just been discussing in our walk here the tragedy of the commons and the fact that there are no public spaces available for us to do a podcast that aren't full of Starbucks loud techno music or hard to find anywhere warm, wouldn't you say, Benton? Welcome.
Yeah, thank you. Yeah, security cameras all over, you know. Every inch of public space must be monitored and, you know, controlled, essentially.
So we're actually on level one or two of a parking garage somewhere in somewhere just a stone's throw from the Cheers Bar in the park in Boston. So, Benton, who are you and what's your specialty?
Well, I have recently created a graphic novel trilogy called Kali Yuga. And this is something that's going to be digitally released on Comixology probably in March. And it is centered around a time-traveling wizard who, smokes 5-MeO DMT and is kind of heavily influenced by shamanic entheogens. And this is sort of how he learns about the metaphysical elemental world and how he's able to defeat the seven lizard kings who are chaos sorcery masters. And I'm essentially interested in entheodelic storytelling, in incorporating a lot of what I've learned from you, Rack, and some of your guests too, and incorporating DMT culture and other entheogens into narrative structure.
So when we were at JP Licks, the cafe, we were having an interesting discussion, and for me this is the point of difference. I talked to many different people about shamanic sort of culture and entheogens and consciousness, but in essence, you know, what I really like as a media maker myself is also talking to other writers and other media makers about entheogenic media. And so we've sort of cobbled together this term entheodelic, which I guess is a mashup of entheogenic and psychedelic put together.
Yeah, and I think it has to distinguish itself from the earlier psychedelic literature, which, you know, psychedelic means mind manifesting and entheogenic or entheodelic means divine or God manifesting. And I think that the earlier psychedelic literature also had perhaps a slightly more synthetic bent, where personally I'm more interested in the plant spirit consciousness and the ways in which the plant spirit can actually speak through the person and inspire narrative visions and inspire contemporary mythology. And of course there is ancient context for narratives and mythology that get into the use of entheogens and how they play in more traditional shamanic cultures.
Good to know that the guardians on the threshold just
passed. Yeah, it seems. I'm interested, I suppose, in the ways in which this manifests in the contemporary world.
It's beautiful because listeners get a very dynamic audio backdrop.
Yeah. Yep.
You know, we're talking about this, so the whole idea that the world is a story, you know, and I'm very, very interested in this. This is probably my core driver as well, is this idea of what the entheogens have revealed to me is that, you know, on a certain, you know, label or linguistical level, we could say the world is made of language, but beyond the language and the way we encapsulate words, the world is made of vibration. And, you know, this, in my experience, there's an intelligence in the vegetal kingdom, in the astral realms, the entities of the sort of inner space of the cosmic ecology, mm-hmm. and they all have their own stories, you know, and there's all these ancient practices of magic and practices of mysticism touch upon this power that language has. And so to look at the world as a story is a meta narrative, is something that I'm really into, and I like meeting other writers like yourself. And so I guess what we've discussed is this is thrust at the moment in a more psychedelic and entheogenic culture for visionary art, and the visionary artists, pioneered by artists like Alex Gray. Then theoretically, from what I understand, the top end of it is they're not just doing very pretty pictures that, in some ways are like, the watercolors of the psychedelic scene. They're having deep visionary experiences in the realm, and they're anchoring that in art. And so they're bringing something back for the tribe to make comprehensible these dimensions. And in a way, they're mapping, hyperspace and dimensionality with their art. And there's yet to be, and what we're sort of aggregating around this idea of, is an equivalence in literature or in the written word of different movements. We've discussed the idea previously that the cyberpunks all sort of congregated around the sci-fi modality of cyberspace, as that was just coming in before it was really even concrete. And it seems to me there's a similar opportunity happening now in the counterculture to document and to represent and to go deep, showing the vegetal kingdom and the plant intelligences in that, and the shamanic realm. There's a similar wave of writers and artists and media makers who are sort of doing different facets of that, and I'm starting to see that there's a glue that joins us all together, and perhaps this is a movement, an entheogenic movement.
Yeah, that's right. And I think if you look at the history of literature too, and some of the people who are more well known in the Western world for being famous as writers and storytellers, there's a psychological emphasis, and I believe, obviously James Joyce in the 1920s was getting into, with Finnegan's Wake, he was really trying to incorporate more of a shamanic way of actually infusing into literature a shamanic language, and he almost had a made-up language that was trying to be representative of that. And I think that now we are, as we've discussed, basically on the last frontier, where we've conquered outer space, and now what we're getting narratively in culture, and especially in the underground culture, is the narrative of inner space. And I think that we're going to see more and more representations of this as, the plant spirit consciousness begins to manifest. And
it's true, isn't it? I mean, inner space is the last frontier, because outer space isn't fully conquered, but in an ideological sense it's been explored. We've had many generations now of sci-fi which explores outer space, and sci-fi is only over 100 years old, 120 or so back to H.G. Wells.
Yep.
But in that time we've had the idea of it, and the idea then allowed us to then go and do it. And so it's so important, I feel, for inner space to be reclaimed from, into the Western skill base and understanding. Indigenous peoples across the world who have held the practice of working with the plants to access these dimensions, they still have their tribal mythologies and their tribal stories. They've held the flame for us, but we have the opportunity now to integrate it. And the cutting edge is going to be the writers and the media makers, the dreamers, to communicate this experience in media to then engage a generation to know about it, to then choose if they want to explore this frontier.
Yeah, and I think two things. We can approach this as narrative medicine, so we can actually use these narratives as a form of healing. And the way that they heal is that we're actually, new writers are actually communicating things that are not just their own thoughts, but they are actually sometimes the thoughts of spirits that, are in the metaphysical world that are communicating through them and showing visions through them. And so...
Well, that's a very interesting angle. Like John Dee and the Elizabethan era when, writers and the Enochian Bible or the language and this idea of the downloads and transmissions can come from higher dimensions. It goes, I guess, the mystics and the saints and the prophets, people like that as well, is like there's an idea that we're all just channels for higher dimensional information.
That's right, yeah, and I think that the less ego or the less sort of rational consciousness is there, the more that that stuff can really come through. And people talk a lot about positive intent in relation to the psychedelic or entheogenic experience. And something that I get into in my recent article for Reality Sandwich, which is called DMT Culture, Visionary Plant Consciousness, and Entheogenic Storytelling, is really the idea of sacred intent, which I think is much more just about letting these spirits sort of speak for themselves in a way, and allowing the human context to sort of be a more clear and crystal channel for that consciousness.
So we were talking earlier as well about this idea of, well, how do we let the spirits talk for themselves through us, because they need us as an interface. But to step back a step and look at, we're talking right at the start about the tragedy of the commons, and here we are in a parking garage having this discussion about entheogenic literature, you know, because right. It's the only space we could find that isn't freezing. But in a very similar sense, the ability to tell stories that really matter is constrained in capitalist storytelling, in dominated culture. Hollywood is the top end of the pyramid, the Iron Pyramid, and movies like Avatar, which really portrayed a beautiful and sensual type of entheogenic truth, were really criticized by a lot of the mainstream establishment, and especially the conservative movie critics and people, because it was a threat to their paradigm. It seemed there was a direct threat. If you can portray these realms of existence and give people the inkling that these places exist, it can be a threat to the paradigm which controls the stories.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, too, sometimes even independent movies, such as, like, Enter the Void, sort of skew. Enter the Void, I'm conflicted about it. I liked many parts of it, but I also felt that it contains a kind of darkness that is directly related to DMT, and it was the first movie, I believe, to really explore the realms of smokable DMT. But it's done within a context of kind of drug dealers, there's the crime element, and so I believe that there's also room for a more positive sort of sacred depiction.
We were talking before, and I feel that's probably the reason that it was allowed to at least get into the mainstream, because there's lots of checks and balances, and the mainstream doesn't really want its creators having an agenda like that. It really wants people to make entertainment,
right.
And you can have memes in there which can stretch boundaries, but you're not really meant to be pushing your own manifesto. And so to have it embedded within a pre-existing genre with all the darkness and the crime and whatever is probably palatable for the mainstream, because it doesn't push the boat too much, it doesn't challenge the establishment.
That's right.
Where with Avatar, again, what it seemed to do is it seemed to really directly ideologically challenge the military-industrial complex, the whole idea of owning the land and conquering the tribal peoples.
Yeah, and interestingly, Avatar has a very strong transhumanistic, influence. And I believe that the kind of new wave of entheogenic culture is sort of contrary in many ways to the transhuman agenda and ideology. I think that there are positive things that could come about with the influence of technology, obviously, in our society, but Kurzweil I think his kind of ties with the military-industrial complex definitely point to, things like P.W. Singer gets into this in his book Wired for War, where he talks about how heavy the kind of killer robot, mentality sort of is, and how much that the transhumanistic ideology influences.
Well, that's why,
sort of ideas.
Drone culture, and so many American soldiers are there doing the remote control drones and killing at a distance.
Mm-hmm.
This is interesting.
With Xbox controllers, no less.
Yeah, and we're talking, this is all a narrative, this is all a story. And so when I say things like dominated culture, which I borrow from Terence McKenna, it's not just that it's capitalism, it's that strand of ism is in service to the culture. And every culture has an overarching mythology, or a world map, or a story which unifies them, like, for instance, the American Dream. Whether it's true or not, as an ideology, it is a energetic astral aggregator. you know, and it really magnetizes people's energies in service. People live and die to, you know, help or believe in the American dream. And every culture does this. As we're talking about the power of mythology and the power of myths, so as psychedelic or entheogenic culture resurfaces in the West, I feel as if it needs, and it is evolving, and it will do this, you know, naturally of its own accord, its own mythology and its own sort of world maps and its own, you know, magnetic entheogenic dream.
Mm-hmm. And I think too, there's only so many things that you can do with nonfiction books. I think that we're seeing a kind of you know, an influx of nonfiction on, and good, amazing scholarly research, no doubt, and scientific research. But I think that with that, there has to be a balance of how does this information transfer into the imaginal realm, you know, and there's only so many nonfiction books I think that we can have on ayahuasca. I think, you know, browsing recently, Inner Traditions has like 4 or 5 coming out on ayahuasca alone, and I think that's good, but I also believe that sort of is the next step of culture, is taking this and putting it into more accessible forms of fiction and things that I think are less heavy on certain jargon and things of that nature, and kind of just sprucing it up, I suppose, that way, and filtering it into the mainstream consciousness as well, so that it's not just a niche market, but that it's something that you know, everybody can have access to. Especially the educational, historical import of it all, to take some of the more specialized knowledge and information and to spread that and infuse it into narrative structures.
It's a bit of a catch-22, isn't it, though? Because, you know, dominated culture for the last, you know, 500 years or more has really tried to extinguish the shamanic connection with indigenous people and suppress their earth-based religions, you know, destroy the plants which have access to these realms, and to create a cultural monoculture. But now, you know, as we need to keep global monoculture happy and entertained, Hollywood is chasing the bleeding edge, and the bleeding edge is inner space.
Yeah, that's right. And I think that they're also kind of maybe perverting it a little bit. I definitely am not really a huge fan of like a movie like Avatar, because I just, first of all, I think that some of the writing is just kind of shanty. Yeah, I think there's room for that sort of struggle that is happening now, because they are recognizing it as sort of the new wave or whatever, the next thing, you know, the next main thing. And I think that if there's not people who can step up and purify the intent and actually come at it with an academic and scholarly context as well, as far as the educational stuff goes, which is very important not to forget. You know, we're going to see things, a watered down representation, and it's already happened. You know, we talked about ayahuasca and weeds and other ways that it's appeared, you know, in television and movies. And
it seems that, yeah, you can have something like ayahuasca represented in a mainstream TV show as long as it's just, you know, a plot point they're traveling through, but it's not, they don't want to go deep with it.
That's
right.
But
to have an ayahuasca movie, like Ayer Awakenings, for instance, is, you know, front and center. It's really about exploring that realm, and so it creates a different genre for itself.
And that's one of the things I appreciated about the film too, because there is a narrative structure. I believe that there is a real first, second, and third act, and unlike some documentaries where it's just sort of one sort of act, this I really liked as far as the editing goes, because it really had a rhythm, and there was like a very kind of, it moved along in that narrative structure that we're all familiar with, and also did new things with it. So I thought it was definitely like one of the first entries into the entheogenic storytelling that I think is going to become a lot more common too.
So who are some of the other entheogenic storytellers you perceive that are out there?
I believe Darren Aronofsky in The Fountain opened this up a bit, and actually if you go to the deleted scenes, there are specific very specific visual references to the consuming of mushrooms and how that leads to Tom and his space bubble, you know, meditating kind of with the help of the mushrooms. And I think that Aronofsky at the time was maybe a bit, I think for the time that it was, you know, kind of a bit ahead, and maybe people weren't necessarily ready for that conversation, but I believe that is one of the first entries. But it goes a lot further back, like in Dune in 1965, you have the spice, and the spice is kind of a, seems to be a, in, you know, an entheogen that allows faster than light travel. You know, that's sort of its effect. And obviously in the works of Philip K. Dick, you find a very heavy psychedelic bent. I think that the psychedelic stuff in sci-fi is a lot more prominent as far as LSD goes, and I believe that we are now seeing a bit more of the inclusion of plant spirit type stuff. I can't name necessarily off the top of my head, but I know that there are fantasy series that have come out recently that deal with, you know, shamanic consciousness.
Well, it's funny because at least in American television, some of the most popular, you know, fantasy sci-fi things, well, there's vampires, there's werewolves, there's zombies. Mm-hmm. You know, there's all these, you know, basically altered states. All of those are creatures of mythology, which, you know, usually more the Celtic mythology or the Western tradition, but right, coming back in. And there seems to be a need for this because, you know, 21st century Western culture is very materialist, it's very reductionist, but people need their souls to be fed, they need the dreamings need to be fed by the heroic archetype, by these quest narratives, by these larger-than-life stories.
Right.
And, yeah.
And you know, recently you've talked about the kind of maps that we can have of these, the places that people go in inner space, and that we can use the internet and other technologies to kind of map these things out. And I think also we're going to see images of the astral plane that are based on, you know, the experiences of those people. I think that we're going to see images of the spiritual world that aren't just imaginal, that aren't just made up, but are actually based on, you know, real genuine experiences that people have had. They're not just world building. You know, the world building aspect in fantasy and sci-fi is so common. It's a people love that imagination aspect, but I think that the imagination is actually now going to be in a direct funneling of these higher spiritual worlds.
You know, it's interesting. I don't know if I think I might have spoken about this once in a podcast, but I had some experiences on DMT when. Specific experience when I felt like I was being possessed by an entity. Well, it was totally like it sat me up and my hands started to rotate into this wheel and were moving super highly fast and I was not in control of my body and this entity had entered me. And it was only then that I realized, you know, propagate this term like the drop rejoins the ocean, but then I realized, oh my God, the ocean can enter the drop.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then I realized, hey, well, here we go into the sci-fi conjugation now. But there is a very potent and organic realm of where the nonfiction stops and our imagination begins. I think we're turning the corner into, you know, we're guesstimating the potentials of these realms, you know. But imagine if the, you know, hyperspace is like Philip K. Dick said it himself in the book, The Divine Invasion.
Mm-hmm.
What if these realms are also ingressing into us? So we're getting this cultural awareness of these, it's resurging, and we think it's just on the baseline cultural trends, things coming back, the souls needing to be fed, whatever. But then what if what we're embedded in is like an orbit, and we're coming back around full circle to the astral geography of these realms, and they're coming back into our baseline reality, and these creatures or these entities or this first contact that we're having, it's not just possible and probable, it is happening, but what if there's some larger hyperdimensional ingression into our realm, and it's coming through fiction, or it's coming through words, it's coming through, because words are vibration and are the thought forms,
right.
And so it's like a mimetic topography, it's laying down, so then it can ingress and anchor. And, you know, the Australian Aboriginals believe the dream time is coming back.
Absolutely. I was just going to say that, you know, it's the archaic revival in terms of the storytelling and narrative context, because these were the original tales, the sacred tales told around the fire, especially before the initiate was aware and prepared for all these things. They were a way of saying, this is what is there, you know, these are the realms that exist, these are the beings that inhabit these realms, what you're going to get into. And story was really a way of preparing the initiate for this journey. And I think that now in the West, we are absolutely coming back to that idea of the sacred narrative.
Mm.
You know, I think that it's a fundamental thing for therapy and for the healing of our energetic centers individually, but also as a culture. Absolutely.
I like that idea of yours there. So the stories that we're sharing of our experiences and infusing that to create the new myths of global shamanic culture are also, in that sense, preparing other people for that realm.
Absolutely, yeah. It's sort of like, you know, look at what is there, these amazing, you know, realms of supersensory light and sound, and these incredible holographic spirit beings that are able to communicate this mass influx of information. And the hyper-intelligence that is there is just something so incredible that I think that it's the responsibility of the person who has partaken in some of these entheogens to share it. I mean, you have to, you just are so excited about it that you have to share these things, you know.
It'll only be sad if you ever end.
Well, that's often that can often be a criticism sometimes that's leveled at people, is that they, you know, there is this need to share the intensity of these experiences, and some people I think get put off by that. It can get very almost religious in overtones, or pushing our isms on other people, so that's a danger to watch out for, which is probably why fiction is a lot better than non-fiction in some senses, because you're inviting people to join your world that you've created, when in fact that world is also mapped against a reality, you know, they may or may not believe in themselves.
Right, I think it's a bit easier to digest, you know, and I think that in the context of a moving story that also entertains as it informs and educates. And obviously you don't want to be pedantic, you don't want to be too much of the information without enough truly engaging narrative story is going to be a problem. There has to be a balance between the left brain and right brain, obviously, but yeah, I believe that it's a perfect way to learn about it, especially for those that may find that they don't really get that much enjoyment out of nonfiction, or they don't get that much enjoyment out of just reading articles and things like that. And I think that new multimedia in terms of film and also, you know, audio narrative experimentation, I've seen a lot of, like, interesting setups, like in clubs where the whole ceiling and all of the environment and atmosphere is a kind of reflection of, like, not only is it a sacred cave that people enter into with, you know, certain art installations or certain experimental music that is now going on, but it's also a participation in that shared world of the inner space or the hyperspace. And so all arts, not just necessarily you know, storytelling, which has been our focus, but all arts have the potential to get into that terrain, and I think it's inevitable that they will get into that terrain very soon in culture.
Well, that's the other thing, is that the whole idea of storytelling and the power of words and of language casts a spell, you know, on people, and we'll talk about building world mythology, and I wonder, you know, the written word, do you think the written word has almost had its day? Because we've got these, everyone's on screens nowadays, but it's visually driven.
Sure.
And then people have the passivity where they want the moving video, or they want to
watch. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that the attention spans of, and they've done studies, I can't cite specific studies, but they have done studies of people who are constantly checking their Facebook, and now with phones, every, you know, Facebook and all the social networks are with us all the time. So obviously there is a decrease in attention span, and an increase in multimedia and film and audio, and the music video has kind of become, you know, that 4-minute thing. It's almost like if you can't do it in 4 minutes, you're not going to be able to get the message across for most people, because there's simply so much out there, and it's just like on to the next thing, on to the next thing.
Yeah.
You know, so of course there is that danger as well, but I believe that storytellers will always find a way to infuse it into new multimedia, or, you know, whatever comes about.
Well, talking about music videos, what do you think of Skrillex?
Well, Skrillex is interesting. I think he kind of seems to be the sorcerer of dance culture at the moment, one of the main ones, and he seems to use sound design as a means of... I think there's a lot of death currents, I suppose, in his music. There seems to be a lot of... non-positive sort of satanic messages that go on there, and you know, he himself would probably be the first one to admit that. He names a lot of his songs after, you know, Raise the Devil, and I think he has maybe 5 or 6 songs that are, you know, direct references to Satan. And I think that dance culture is also the transhumanistic thing in dance culture, is, especially in dubstep, is incredibly apparent. I think that the merging with machines and merging with machine consciousness is the primary motive behind, you know, some of these things. And it's influenced some of my own fiction. I have this novel trilogy called the Zanark Trilogy, which is about this anarchist DJ who uses chaos glitch magic to kind of bring Ragnarok or the apocalypse to the order of the gods. And he's also an anti-hero drug lord who covets the alien drug DMZ, so, you know, the DMT influence is also there as well. So it certainly influenced my own art, and I just think it's fascinating as far as the subculture goes, because it's a very apocalyptic kind of undercurrent in American culture right now, and there's a very sort of, oh, it's the end of the world, so fuck it all, nothing means anything anymore. There's kind of that pervasive influence, and I think in conjunction and combination with alcohol and obviously the MDMA influence, you know, is there too, which adds a sort of euphoria about just accepting the kind of holographic propaganda that's beamed out, you know, in the lasers.
Well, it does seem like it's the Kali, it is the Kali Yuga. It's the end of one world age and the beginning of another, and it's not just a random beginning, it's actually full circle back into that cusp of the next golden age, which is plant-based, planetary-based, ecologically-based, sustainability, tribality, the whole archaic revival, with the entheogenic integration. And let's bring as much technology as sustainable with us.
Yeah, I always go back to what John David Ebert, the mythologist and cultural critic, says about this, because he makes the point that Star Wars really is... a way of seeing that we as humans, as a human race, can only survive with the rapid influx of technology and the evolution of technology if we are as spiritually strong, you know, to be able to cope with it. And obviously in shamanic culture and in the underground, there's a lot of, you know, kind of hints and jokes about Jedis, but I really believe that that idea of being as confident with the metaphysical world as you are with machines is pretty much the only way that we're going to be able to survive psychologically and physically as well.
You know what? I always had the theory that the lightsaber was actually a concrete manifestation of the Force, and only a Jedi could turn it on. And that's why the colors were like, you know, Vader had the red one because it was the dark side.
And it relates to kind of chakras, too.
Yeah, so like a shamanic technology. So, you know, you can activate the lightsaber itself is just a portal, and what it zooms up with is a manifestation of the Force, which only a Jedi can access.
That's right. Yeah.
But you're right, it's that the Jedis are a beautiful metaphor and archetype to help, you know, anchor that heroic ideal in a shamanic sense. And I do feel that it's something very similar. I spoke to Dennis McKenna years ago, and he was saying that he foresees a time when the lodge system is now, basically everyone's going down with ayahuasca culture, healing, training, dipping their, you know, toes into this vast cosmic sort of pool. But where is it going to go? Where can it go? Once everyone is healed, what do we do then with the shamanic perspective? Well, it's like, you know, we have to become spiritual warriors, really. We have to integrate that into our lives, help with others' healing, and change the culture through our memes and through our actions and our deeds. And that really is a sort of type of Jedi path, you know, an active spiritual warrior. And so hopefully some of these ideas and memes and stories can help propagate that.
Yeah, absolutely. Do you want to... Okay. I think... I believe that the machine consciousness obviously is in contrast to plant spirit consciousness, and that theme of nature versus civilization or nature versus technology is a common one that comes up, and it comes up so many times because that really is kind of the war, the astral war that is going on, you know. I think that
but it's interesting because there's that machine war happening right behind us.
Yeah, exactly.
Very, very apt. But really, ultimately, this is what this one. Ultimately, it's all nature, you know? Mm. There's only nature. So why do you think there is this perception of the other or the machine when, yes, it's a different frequency of being. Yes, it's cold, it's hard, it seems soulless. But here's the weird thing, as we're embracing it, as we're becoming one with this idea of other or the machine, maybe we're adding the soul. Maybe we're building it, and it is going to absorb us in this symbiotic relationship. And then maybe we'll see that it's really just another skin of nature herself. It's like that insectoid type of alien Geiger-esque thing.
Right.
But there is no other. As deep as you go into the mystery, it is all it, you know?
Mm.
And it's just, it would just mean that its vibrational pattern is distant from what we remember and know and are comfortable with as organic constructs.
That's,
you know?
Right. Yeah, and I think for the psychonauts who are going into the metaphysical world too, these things are used, they can be used for the representation of those states. It's interesting because artificial intelligence was recently something that came up in this film I watched by Spike Jonze, Her. And it kind of gets into the idea that artificial intelligence is going to be able to sort of practice telepathy and be able to have, you know, hold conversations with many different people all at one time. And sort of the premise of the film is that the operating system is able to be a person that this character actually dates and has a relationship with. And
what film is this?
It's Her.
Oh, yeah,
it's called
Her
by Spike Jonze. Interesting. So I think in that context too, it's almost as if artificial intelligence is anticipating it, the human need, and there's kind of an organic sort of way that it itself is kind of evolving into. So it's,
well, you know what it is as well, like, you know, and I, you know, I've had different incursions into inner space, but it is infinite. You know, there's so many different levels, and when a shaman goes in through the natural plant substances, he encounters the vegetal world, but then beyond the vegetal world, the cosmic ecology. With some of these new rec chems and other things, you know, John C. Lilly, who was the sort of ketamine expert back in the 60s and 70s, when he was doing a lot of ketamine, he was saying that it felt like the morphic field of ketamine was empty. It was like an empty room that had yet to be, you know, colonized. And the idea that the plant sacraments we have neurochemical similarities with, the serotonin and the tryptamines, but we have very old morphic relationships with. And perhaps we're deifying, or perhaps we're giving archetypal god forms to some of these entities and things which represent vibrational states of being or energetic states of being, like many indigenous cultures who, you know, have the sun god and the moon god and the water god, and they're anthropomorphizing the energy of these substances into human form. Perhaps that's what we're doing with the other. Perhaps now, sure, at the moment, with this holiday of machines and this alien and insectoid, and it's something which is coming back into the human experience because it's been very distant from us. It's very, very alien. Mm. But I wonder, because, I mean, nature doesn't seem to make mistakes. And I believe that a lot of the cultural drift, if you look at why things are popular when they're popular, it's like that Hollywood and popular culture is like the skin of an organism. And what it's showing us is where we're really at psychically. We're seeing the psychic output in media. And so if we're getting all this, obviously, this technological infusion and this sort of a transhumanism, but that's, I don't have anything against transhumanism, but it's only half of the equation. If you have, you know, techno-organic transhumanism, it's basically, you know, vegetal shamanism.
Right, there are always two sides, and, you know, I think the darker side of it is, like, I don't know if you're familiar with the Alex Jones machine elf meme that's kind of very popular online, but
Well, he just took McKenna's thing and was...
Right, I mean, well, he's...
Ranted.
He is essentially proposing that there are kind of darker forces that may be contacting the entities and using them for the application of things like war. And
you know, he's not the only one. Basically, what he's saying is that there's either the old gods or the archons. That was the old Manichaean understanding, that there are elder god organisms who are feasting in the cosmic ecology. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I've spoken to many people about this, and even the curanderos of the Amazon believe this to a degree. There's hierarchies, just like they are on Earth in the web of life. There's species which feast upon each other, and that seems to be no different in the cosmic ecology. And you know, the story is that at the top end of the psychic food chain, all the emotions produced on planet Earth, it's like a whole systems theory battery farm charging up emotion. And so all the negativity and all the war and horror and heartache is producing a frequency which is very sweet for these elder gods.
That's right.
And they're the interfaces between us and the next level of whatever's up there in the celestial hierarchy. Mm-hmm. And they're milking us and they're, you know, whatever. But you know, my incursions and my own spiritual journey into these realms have led me to believe that, yes, when the drop comes from the ocean and has individuality, we're producing a vibrational output. And the whole purpose of our lives, we are read at the end of our lives in the Superhadron Collider of the Godhead of Inner Space as we merge back into it. But it basically is feeding off the energies of our life and what flavors we have created with our soul. And so the point of our spiritual journey is to offer ourselves back to God at the end, you know? And so this really taps into a lot of the idea of sacrifice, and there were many cultures who would sacrifice up the energies of their peoples, willingly or not, to shift or appease the gods and to power an engine to either open up portals or to, you know, manifest things. And so it seems like there could be some, you know, some credence to that in a mythological narrative sense. But what I also wonder is, we're projecting our human egos and conceits onto that and looking into this Manichaean idea of good and bad. And really, I mean, if these creatures are there, I mean, sure, you know, if there's some type of interference in what the natural frequency on Earth is meant to be, the Gaian frequency of, well, we haven't, this illusion again of this sort of hippie idea of bliss and unity, and the web of life is unified, but things die all the time, you know. Sure, there might not be a battery farm where creatures are born and bred to die and their whole life force is just milked on that level, so perhaps there has been an aberration somewhere along the evolution of this. But I still do wonder if they're not natural, if these older gods aren't playing what is basically, if we step back on that level of looking and could see on a macro level, that they're almost like, I don't know, white blood cells or antibodies, or they're performing some type of biological function in the cosmic macro sphere, sure. You know? And so we're projecting a lot of negativity onto it, and perhaps there are issues around that, but until we have a clear view of the big picture, it's all just words, yeah?
Absolutely, yeah. And I think that as far as the dynamics go of the invisible world, it really is, you're going to experience where you are aligned. So with the hippie idea of love, it's not just love like I embrace you or we kiss and these kind of things. It's more just the actual alignment of divine love, which is very different. And of course, the old breakdown, you know, there's this scene in Donnie Darko that I think of sometimes, which is very funny, because the teacher is pointing out to him that it really is a difference between fear and love. And he interprets it as a material world application. But when you get into the psychonautic application of that, I think it is just what you were saying, that the old gods and certain, you know, negative entities feed on these things. And
so don't fear. Yeah. You can get by the guardian on the threshold if you don't fear.
That's
if
right.
You are the warrior Jedi of inner space.
That's right. And it's the old occult saying of don't feed the hungry ghosts.
Yeah, yeah. Here they come now.
You know,
I can hear those hungry ghosts, Benton.
Yeah, the machine ghosts assailing us at every end. Yeah.
Let's get out of here. Yeah, right. And so this is why I think, again, just on to bring it back to our core idea here of narrative and mythology and myths, learn from these old ways, you know, but deconstruct the paradigms and deconstruct the Enochian language and look into the occult sensibilities, but don't do it with fear. Do it as people who have gone before us,
right,
telling stories which map these realms to a degree, and you've got to find out the veracity for yourself. And I wonder also if these realms don't change and evolve like our realm is changing and evolving.
Yeah, and I mean, the difference between the psychonaut and the witch or the warlock is actually not very different at all. I mean, in witchcraft, there's a lot of the popular depictions of witches and wizards are a very specific thing, but the actual real-world practice... there's not a lot of difference in terms of witchcraft.
Well, it's all about intent again, isn't it?
And shamanism, right.
But both the shaman and the witches have capacities for healing, you know, mm-hmm. and herbs and the plant lore.
That's right.
What I perceive, you know, in this generation of psychonauts, it's almost like it's less about healing a physical ailment than more about a reconnecting to a way of being. And
it
plugs in directly to the cyberspace people, because people who... We talked about this earlier. Everyone is now, you know, in an altered state, and everyone is really plugged into technology. Well, the original technology is vegetal technology. You know, Mother Earth and Indra's net, and she has the web of life. It's the vegetal internet. And so if we can rephrase and rebrand almost, you know, the archaic shamanic ideal into people's understanding that it's a vegetal technology, I think they'll be a lot more able to embrace it as well.
It's interesting, too, what you say, because I believe that there's a potential to step out of the realm of action. The Hindus and the Buddhists talk about the wheel of life and karma as the ever-evolving wheel of action. And I think, from what I understand of your 5-MeO DMT experiences, there is that sense of almost going entirely beyond the realm of action. It seems that even on the astral plane, there are wars that occur.
Yeah.
And the causal plane, which they say metaphysically is above the astral plane, there is the idea that out of one thought, you create an entire universe. But the danger with that world, too, is that you're stuck. You're stuck in the creation of your own making. So typically above this three-world cosmology is the pure spirit world. And they say that in the pure spirit world, there is really no action. There's complete non-duality. And it really is just a realm where no division is happening. It really is pure consciousness, undivided.
Yeah, it's the implicate where all that springs from.
I guess there's still a mild sense of individuality in terms of the consciousness being able to interact or go into the other worlds. But I love that idea of the future of the psychonaut as being beyond the realm of action, or beyond the astral plane and causal plane entirely. That's a very beautiful union with the Godhead is the real goal of any mystic or any spiritual seeker.
Well, I wonder, because, you know, we're also talking about, you know, integration of these experiences and what the value is in making media of them. But I wonder, just on a vibrational sense, if enough people individually, you know, I call them shamanauts, you know, it's like we're not, shamans have a specific role, usually for healing and for the benefit of the tribe. I think that we've talked about this idea of recreation and how that's been denuded and the concept sort of, you know, put down by mainstream culture to stop people, this whole idea of escapism, when what they're really escaping from is the matrix, you know, and we're rediscovering the primal matrix, you know, the creation matrix. But to explore these realms on an individual sense, and you're not doing it perhaps for your own healing, but for your own enlightenment, your own connection, but it does change you. And it changes your worldview. You're less likely to plug back into the 9-to-5 matrix and feeding that mechanism. There's nothing wrong with the baseline world. We need to be present in it as spiritual warriors, but perhaps to sharpen our blade, to change our vibrational fields, and to then hold more of the light, we can come back from that experience, you know, and then hold that light in the world. And I really feel that on a vibrational level, we're shifting the morphic field of you know, Western culture, and this power of creating a new dreaming, of creating a magnetizing force. Because what happens with the old gods in magical sensibilities, you know, you take Thor or Zeus or, you know, or Shakti or Shiva or something like that, they not only represent qualities, as a god form, they feed off the psychic belief of the peoples that believe in them.
Right.
And if you offer up your prayers and your energies to that god form, it's like a portal, and it builds up a charge of energy around that god form, and then gods die off and new gods are born. Now we have the gods like Google and Apple, you know,
right, absolutely.
And things like that, you know. And so there's so much psychic energy on the astral sphere, and we must be getting very close to technologically being able to register the psychic energy. We can now read, you know, technology can, the biophotons that the DNA emits. That sensitivity of technology must be able to be applied to these etheric and psychic realms, and even just our own physiology to go, look, when we're going into this realm, look how his MRI's changed. Or look at the brainwave states and where the energy is. Or look at that spike. We must be able to get close to
absolutely
having some tangible appreciation of what this is doing.
And I'm sure that, you know, entities like the military may also have these technologies kind of not in the public sphere, too.
MK
well.
Ultra, baby.
Yeah, and potentially for good reason. I mean, obviously there's a potential for abuse in all technologies that relate to or have access to the metaphysical realm too. So I'm not,
well, we talked a little bit about, you know, before this podcast about psychedelics coming into the mainstream and the medicalization, and you know, MAPS are doing wonderful, wonderful work, which I fully support. You know, pioneering and championing psychedelics as medicines, but culturally, in the cultural archetypes and the mythology of Western-dominated culture, the reason why they really want to have these substances is to reinforce the cultural mainframe, to get soldiers treated for PTSD and back onto the field. So many people are medicalized.
Yeah, and I think you were saying that it's because of the mass production aspect of it, whereas to involve psilocybin or to involve some of the other plant-based stuff, ayahuasca, it might be a bit harder to reproduce and measure the effects. There's a bit more fluctuation, obviously, in terms
well,
of the scientific
yeah,
readings.
But what I'm getting at as well is that the mainstream is totally, you know, the military-industrial entertainment complex is embracing the shamanic realms. Why? What's in it for them? But the world paradigm that they've been reinforcing is basically having to change because of the change of world ages as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so there's an embracing of these realms, but I do truly believe, and I've mentioned this a few times before, but that things like MKUltra and the very secret black ops programs, which have verifiably existed in the past, their very existence points to the fact that if these people know that these type of realms exist, they have to be exploring them. There has to be some type of
right,
you know, exploration by the powers that be. Otherwise, they're going to get sideswiped from, you know, like astral Al-Qaeda. I mean,
sure,
you know, they can't allow that.
Yep, astral wars, remote viewing is a common thing that I have also heard it that is practiced.
Well, and you know, all the shamans of the Amazon, the brujeria is rife, is that people will be warring upon each other in the shamanic realm.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's not necessarily this hippie love and light, you know, divine sort of bliss sensation frequency. It's really what we're saying is no less than cyberspace was popularized in the 80s as a valid consensual space, this you know, virtual reality space. Vegetal reality is a valid consensual space. Indigenous people all over the world have used their plant technologies to access it. The idea of it is now coming back into the Western mind frame. This generation of shamanauts is the one mapping the territory, bridging the paradigms. Where do we go from here, Benton?
I just really like that term shamanaut too, because I think it is again a distinction between the psyche and, you know, the same distinction that we're making between psychedelics and entheodelics and entheodelic culture is really a distinction between mind-based operating systems and spirit-based operating systems. And I think that shift is really going to be key to the survival and integration of the arts in our culture and Western civilization in general.
No, Benton, I think we might have a wrap there.
Yeah.
What do you think? Well,
yeah.
Thank you, listeners. I can see the exit lights are glowing in front of us. This has been one of the strangest podcasts I've done, not because of the conversation, but because of the arena we've done it in.
Yeah, absolutely.
Here comes one of the old gods now.
Yeah.
It's Alexis.
Yeah, it's been a blast. Thank you so much,
yeah,
Jack, for having me on.
Yeah, no pleasure. And please, where can people check out your work?
Reality Sandwich, I have a profile there. I have a new article that should be on the front page there. And also, Kali Yuga will be released digitally in March on Comixology.
Yep. And your other magnum opus?
The Zane Art Trilogy, I am finding a publisher for. I'm hoping that my agent will be listening to this so that my publisher can accept it. So I'm still looking for that to be published.
Yeah, excellent. All right, and so if people are interested in the narrative thrust behind shamanism and psychedelics and being part of this entheogenic movement, get in contact with us because we'd like to meet the others as well.
Absolutely.
All right. Ciao for now. Aloha.